This is VOA News, reporting by remote. I'm Joe Ramsey. Russian and Ukrainian officials have signed deals to safely export wheat and other food staples across the Black Sea. Ukraine is one of the world's key breadbaskets, but a Russian blockade of its ports during the war has threatened food security around the world. The two countries signed separate agreements Friday in Istanbul with Turkey and the UN so Ukraine could export 22 million tons of grain and other food stuck in Black Sea ports. The UN chief called the deal a, quote, beacon of hope on the Black Sea that will help millions of hungry people around the world.
This is an agreement for the world. It will bring relief for developing countries on the edge of bankruptcy and the most vulnerable people on the edge of famine.
Judges at the United Nations highest court have dismissed preliminary objections by Myanmar to a case alleging the Southeast Asian nation is responsible for genocide against the Rohingya ethnic minority. The decision Friday clears the way for the highly charged case brought by Gambia to go ahead at the International Court of Justice, a process that will take years. It sets the stage for court hearings airing evidence of atrocities against the Rohingya that human rights groups say amount to breaches of the 1948 Genocide Convention. U.S. Development Agency USAID will provide Kenya with $255 million in emergency and development assistance to tackle drought, Administrator Samantha Power said on Friday. The Kenyan government says 4.1 million people in the East African nation are food insecure. That's up from 3.8 million in March this year. This is VOA News. A political ally of the former president has been appointed Sri Lanka's prime minister hours after army troops and police forcefully cleared the main protest site occupied for months by demonstrators. AP correspondent Charles Day Ledesma reports.
Heavy security was present outside Sri Lanka's presidential office hours after the forces had moved in on the major protest site early on Friday. Hashani Siriwadana, a lawyer and protester, tells the AP soldiers had come and brutally beaten peaceful protesters and destroyed camps.
Some of the protesters in the hospital, they are badly injured and some of arrested and also lawyers are also arrested.
Siriwadana adds she's disappointed by the heavy approach adopted by the new president, Ranil Wickremesinghe, who was chosen by lawmakers earlier this week.
I think President is a coward and he took cowardly action against the peaceful protesters.
I'm Charles Diladesma.
The U.S. lawmakers investigating the January 6, 2021 United States Capitol riot have ended its summer hearing series and promising more to come. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The dam has begun to break.
Vice Chair Liz Cheney says more doors have opened, more subpoenas issued. And as the panel's work continues, every American has to consider this.
Can a president who is willing to make the choices Donald Trump made during the violence of January 6th ever be trusted with any position of authority?
While Chairman Benny Thompson notes the panel cannot make criminal charges.
There needs to be accountability.
Merrick Garland's Justice Department is watching.
We have to get this right.
The Attorney General calls it his department's most wide-ranging and most important investigation ever. Cheney says the committee will keep pushing on its own.
And we will see you all in September.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
Recapping our top story, Russian and Ukrainian officials have signed deals to safely export wheat and other food staples across the Black Sea. Ukraine is one of the world's key breadbaskets, but a Russian blockade of its ports during the war has threatened food security around the world. The two countries signed separate agreements Friday in Istanbul with Turkey and the UN so Ukraine could export 22 million tons of grain and other food stuck at Black Sea ports. The UN chief calling the deal a beacon of hope on the Black Sea that will help millions of hungry people around the world. Find more on our website, voanews.com, or follow us on the VOA mobile app. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
A decade after Tunisians toppled their longtime dictator, Zine El Abidine Ben Ali, and unleashed the broader Arab Spring uprising, this North African country may be at another crossroads.
That was reporter Lisa Bryant on Tunisia's referendum next Monday on a proposed new constitution that critics say would give President Kais Saied too much power. Details coming up. Also, Russia and Ukraine signed a deal today to reopen grain exports from Ukraine's ports. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Exactly a year after Tunisia's President Kais Saied fired his government, suspended parliament, and seized sweeping powers, its citizens vote Monday on a draft constitution that critics fear could pull the fledgling Arab Spring democracy back to authoritarian rule. For VOA, Lisa Bryant has more from Tunis.
A decade after Tunisians toppled their longtime dictator, Zine El Abidine Ben Ali, and unleashed the broader Arab Spring uprising, this North African country may be at another crossroads. President Kais Saied says his proposed constitution, which would sharply strengthen presidential powers and weaken legislative ones, aims to return the country to the revolution's pro-people principles. But a kaleidoscope of rights groups and opposition parties argue otherwise. Many want Tunisians to boycott the referendum. Rita Dries is political advisor to the El Nahda party.
Mr. Kais Saied is trying to build a dictatorial regime with all powers concentrated in his hands. The referendum's outcome is a foregone conclusion.
N'a aucun enjeu, c'est-à-dire le jeu, il est déjà fait.
Even the head of an expert committee that drafted the charter earlier this year disavows the final version. Nedjer Sharif says it's nothing like the original.
For the president, the country has been ruled by a corrupted elite for the last couple of years, and he's trying to bring it back on the right path. From the opposition perspective, obviously, what's happening is a break to democracy and the democratic transition, because the president has been preparing this constitution almost on his own.
Many Tunisians are less worried about politics than about making ends meet amid a stuttering economy and soaring joblessness and inflation, especially since the war in Ukraine. Experts say many don't know the details of the draft constitution.
I'm voting for the constitution Monday because I love my president and my country.
Tunisia's first post-revolution constitution in 2014 took 2 years to draft after wide-ranging input. It established a mixed parliamentary presidential system. But it wasn't a silver bullet to the country's economic and political problems. Saied, who shot to power in 2019 as a political outsider, hasn't been able to fix them either. Still, people cheered last year when he suspended the country's bickering parliament. Even today, experts say he retains fading but sizable support. Nedjer Sharif.
Saied is the most popular person on the scene, and he's largely more popular than any of those parties and all the opposition together. Today, I think most of the opposition parties have lost their credibility among the people.
Experts predict voter turnout for Monday's referendum will be low, but the constitution is likely to pass. Tunisians may be writing the next chapter of their history out of default instead of revolt. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Tunis.
To cement his power grab, Tunisian President Kais Saied has been counting on a passive response from the country's allies in the European Union and the United States, which have only issued verbal admonishments. The most recent EU statement was especially passive. It merely takes notes of concerns about the proposed new constitution that will be the subject of a referendum Monday. some counter-revolutionary players in the Arab world contributed to Saeed's power grab. Radwan Masmoudi, president of the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi how the international community could save Tunisia from a potential one-man rule.
I think the United States and the European Union have so far paid only lip service to the idea of helping and supporting democracy and the democratic process in Tunisia. Yes, they have issued repeated calls throughout the year urging Qais Saied to restore democracy and to start a genuine and inclusive dialogue. But he has obviously ignored all those repeated requests for an entire year now. He has not listened to those requests. So it's time for the U.S. and the international community to realize that this approach has not worked and to change course and adopt a more forceful approach with Qais Saied. I think the Tunisian democracy can still be saved. And of course, it is up to the Tunisians themselves to fight for their own democracy. But the international community also has an important role and a huge responsibility in supporting this nascent democracy, the only successful democracy in the Arab world. And I think the United States can do so very easily by doing three things. Number one, announcing immediately after July 25 that this referendum was not free and fair or transparent, and therefore that they will not recognize, that the international community will not recognize this new constitution. And this is very, very important, because if the constitution is not recognized by the international community, it will not take effect effectively in Tunisia. Number two, demand that the military stays out of politics and refrains from prosecuting civilians in military courts. Or if the military doesn't do that, then withhold all future economic and military assistance to Tunisia. And number three, announce that the IMF loan, which Tunisia desperately needs, will not be approved unless Tunisia restores democracy and respect the rule of law and the constitution of 2014, which is the only legitimate constitution that Tunisians have agreed upon in 2014. I think these three steps together will make a big difference in restoring democracy in Tunisia.
President Qais Saied, though legitimately elected in 2019, has been using his power to undermine the country's once promising political institutions established in the wake of the 2011 uprising against a dictatorship. Tunisia's revolt triggered the Arab Spring, which has tragically failed or been defeated by dictators around the Middle East. How did the counter-revolutionary players in the Arab world contribute to the power grab in Tunisia by President Saeed?
Tunisia was the only successful democracy in the Arab world for the past 10 years, since 2011. And this success story was very important for the Arab world to show that democracy can indeed succeed in the Arab world. Of course, other oppressive and tyrannical regimes in the Arab world do not want to see democracy succeed in Tunisia or anywhere else in the Arab world, because they see it as a threat to their own regimes. So they have done and are doing everything they can to undermine and destabilize this young democracy. In particular, Egypt, United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia have been involved since day one in supporting this coup against democracy and supporting the actions of Qais Saied. And the Egyptian military intelligence has been involved on the ground in Tunisia in providing logistical and media support to Qais Saied. So I'm confident that democracy will succeed and will be restored in Tunisia despite all these efforts, and that the Tunisian people will continue to fight for their freedom and for their democracy. But we do need the support of all democratic nations in the world, especially the United States and the European Union. Tunisian democracy can be saved and can be restored with minimum cost and minimum effort. So this will be a big test for Congress and for the Biden administration.
That was Radwan Masmoudi, president of Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy, speaking with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. President Joe Biden will host a summit with leaders from African continent to demonstrate enduring U.S. commitment to Africa and foster increased cooperation on shared global priorities. The agenda is ambitious and wide-ranging: economic engagement, democracy and human rights, COVID-19 and future pandemics, food security, peace and security, climate change and diaspora ties. The U.S. has said it expects about 50 African leaders to attend in December. David Aworawo is a professor of international relations and strategic studies and head of Department of History and Strategic Studies at the University of Lagos. He told reporter Mike Mbonier the summit is aimed at strengthening global collaboration and security.
The gap between the developed countries and the global south is widening. The coronavirus pandemic and the way it was approached, the way it has been, you know, handled and managed so far, shows the need for closing that gap. So, the coronavirus pandemic also showed that global collaboration is critical to, you know, global development and global peace. So any move that is made to further promote and strengthen global collaboration is in the right direction.
What's your take on some of these issues to be discussed at the summit?
These are exactly the issues I expect, this kind of summit to sketch out to address. Because there are issues that face humanity in the contemporary period. You know, for instance, COVID-19, it hasn't gone away yet. And you know that when the vaccines were made available a couple of months ago, Africa was left behind. And there were these efforts to assist Africa and also empower Africa enable Africa to develop greater capacity to be able to handle these issues. Diaspora links, economic, stronger economic ties. All of those issues that have been outlined to be, discussed at the summit are actually the issues that confront humanity at the moment, and it is worth taking. We hope that there will be sincerity of purpose in discussing them, and there will be commitment to ensuring that whatever is agreed to when the summit holds, there is a commitment to implementing such that both the United States and African states and indeed the global community can be better off. Coming straight to the issue of wheat supply, what the American authorities have said is assisting Africa to develop capacity to be able to produce wheat and other grains to be food secure and reduce dependence on external supplies, of course, notably Russia and then Ukraine.
The issue of insecurity in Nigeria, in the Sahel, and in other parts of Africa, do you think the summit will in any way assist Africa overcome some of these challenges?
Certainly. The United States has already been involved in trying to assist the countries of the Sahel to tackle terrorism because when there is terrorism in one part of the world, the entire global community is affected one way or the other. There have been bilateral agreements on several issues, training the forces of these countries, supply of, weapons. Of course, Nigeria has benefited from such supplies under the Biden administration. All of these things are the things that the United States has already done even before the summit.
That was David Aworawo, professor of international relations and strategic studies at the University of Lagos, speaking with reporter Mike Mbonier by phone from Lagos, Nigeria. You're listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. Please note we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. Online sales boomed during the COVID-19 pandemic, including those in some parts of Africa, where industry analysts say online trade is expected to grow by over half in the next 3 years. The continent's online market potential faces numerous challenges. For VOA, Linda Giftach reports from Johannesburg.
Small businesses like Tsepo Jeans, a denim retailer in Johannesburg, are gearing up for a boom in e-commerce. Some parts of Africa have seen double-digit growth in online shopping year over year, with more than 334 million users today. Market data firm Statista projects the trend will continue, topping 519 million shoppers by 2025. For denim seller Tsepo Malala, this doesn't come as a surprise.
The Tsepo brand truly started on social media. You know, before we even had any stores, we were online. So I've seen the growth since day one.
The brand, which launched in 2015, has survived the pandemic through its online store. The digital traffic has been maintained even after the reopening of physical shops. Experts say it is a trend driven largely by the rise of smartphone access across Africa. Mercy Mpingjira is the director of the School of Consumer Intelligence and Information Systems at the University of Johannesburg.
Internet penetration was low in the early years of e-commerce, and because of that, the levels of e-commerce were low. But now, with the coming in of mobile telephony, it has changed things around. We're talking about over 80% of people on the continent having access to mobile phones, and that is enabling them to access things online and be able to also transact online.
Mpingjira says other challenges continue to hinder e-commerce in Africa. Many people do not use banks, complicating digital payments. There are also logistical issues with delivery, with traditional mail being slow and inconvenient. Unreliable postal systems, though, have paved the way for new courier companies to emerge. Craig Pitchers is the chief operating officer for The Courier Guy, a delivery business in South Africa.
The postal service is not that convenient. So if you look at the number of courier players in the market, and the community is spoiled for choice in terms of who they can use. One of the areas we've innovated around the growth in e-commerce is the introduction of our electronic lockers, which we call PUDO, Pick Up Drop Off.
More Africans are embracing online shopping, but experts, as well as retailers like Mohlala, say it's not replaced the experience of going into physical stores.
From a growth perspective, I think our stores, our brick and mortar, are still doing far much better compared to our digital presence at the moment. Kind of gave us like a platform to have more customers coming in, touching our product, feeling our product, and we could also execute on our bespoke experience.
While some consumers will always prefer shopping in person, e-commerce has opened up a new way for small businesses to reach new clients. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Russia and Ukraine signed a deal today to reopen grain exports from Ukrainian Black Sea ports. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres and Turkey's President Tayyip Erdogan said the agreement would help ease a global food crisis. Government ministers from Russia and Ukraine signed the deal separately to avoid sitting at the same table and avoided shaking hands at the event in Istanbul. At the signing ceremony, Guterres said, "Today there is a beacon on the Black Sea, a beacon of hope." Erdogan said the deal, which Turkey also signed, will help prevent famine and ease global food inflation. Russia and Ukraine are two of the largest exporters of wheat and other grains, but shipments halted when Russia invaded Ukraine in February, creating shortages and driving prices sharply higher. Many African nations are particularly dependent on grain exports from the two countries. On August 9th, 2022, Kenyans will cast their ballots for a new president and legislators. Incumbent President Uhuru Kenyatta, barred by the Constitution from seeking a third term, has thrown his support behind opposition challenger Raila Odinga over his own deputy president, William Ruto. John Makum Mbaku is a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a professor of economics and development at Weber State University. In part two of our conversation, I started out by asking about the strategy behind Uhuru's endorsement of his rival, Odinga.
One of the things we have to understand here is that political alliances in Kenya, political coalitions, they are formed primarily for purposes of winning elections, making certain that once the elections are completed, there is violence is minimized. Now, it's very difficult to understand why President Uhuru abandoned his vice president and instead decided to support that. Mr. Kenyatta's thinking was that the Odinga and the Luo have been patiently waiting to capture the presidency for so long that there may have been fears that if Odinga is not successful this time, there could be significant violence. Now, Mr. Ruto is a much younger person, and if he's not successful this time, still has another chance to campaign for president, whereas Mr. Odinga is getting quite in age. My evaluation of Mr. Kenyatta's decision, and again, I don't know what he had in mind, is that perhaps he might have been feeling that supporting the Odinga-led alliance would provide greater opportunities for a peaceful transition in Kenya after this election, simply because if Mr. Odinga were to lose the election, we could see significant problems, primarily because the Luo, as many surveys have shown, are very impatient because they have been waiting for so long to have one of them in power as a president.
Elections scheduled for 2022 are in Chad, Comoros, Djibouti, Equatorial Guinea, the Gambia, Lesotho, Libya, Mali, Mauritius, Republic of the Congo, Sao Tome Principe, Sierra Leone, Sudan, and Tunisia. So the success of the Kenyan elections highly reflects on what could happen in those other countries as well. Do you think so?
Yes. The thing is that Kenya has had a lot of problems with elections over the years. But in the last election, Kenyans did very well. And the hope is that if Kenyans do well again in this election, Kenya would be putting itself as a beacon for other countries that are suffering with respect to elections, because Kenyans will be telling those other countries that elections are not just about individuals from different ethnic groups gaining power and trying to benefit their own groups, but that elections are a way to build a nation, to build a democracy, to build the rule of law, to build institutions that can help not just some people, but everybody within the country develop. So yes, I believe that the Kenyan elections are very important, not just for Kenya, but also for other countries, because it can teach all these other countries that you've mentioned how to use elections as a transformative mechanism, not just as a mechanism to allow some individuals to get into government, but as a mechanism that can transform the entire country and provide the country with the opportunity to begin to develop systems that can empower people, especially young people, and give them hope. And I believe that Kenya can begin to do that by teaching its neighbors, South Sudan, Ethiopia, Uganda, and so on, how to live together peacefully. And this is the hope that I have for Kenya in August.
That was John Mukum Mbaku, non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and professor of economy and development at Weber State University. He talked to me from the town of Ogden in the U.S. state of Utah. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yeheyis Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Shogun Chang, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays.